At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Megan Bryson centers gender as an analytical framework in the study of Buddhism. The benefit of this approach is vividly demonstrated in Goddess on the Frontier, Religion, Ethnicity, and Gender in Southwest China, which uncovers the transformation of the goddess Baijie over several centuries. Bryson's research explores the various social and historical contexts of the Dali region in Southwest China, where the deity was shaped by local expressions of the Buddhist tradition. Baijie was depicted as a Buddhist goddess, the mother of Dali's founder, a widowed martyr, and a village divinity. Bryson combines the exploration of historical sources and ethnographic encounters with contemporary Baijie worshippers to offer a nuanced and far-reaching portrait of the goddess. In our conversation, we discussed Chinese and Indian formulations of Buddhism, the Buddhist history of the Dali region, how local Dali elites narrativized the goddess, stories of dragons, issues of Han migration, the Ming and Qing gendered social norms and expectations, and how notions of the categories religion and ethnicity shape recent interpretations of Baijie. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion on the New Books Network. Without any further delay, here is my conversation with Megan Bryson about Goddess on the Frontier, Religion, Ethnicity, and Gender in Southwest China, published with Stanford University Press in 2016. Welcome, Megan. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you?
Doing pretty well. How about yourself?
I'm good, yeah. And it was exciting to read this wonderful book, Goddess on the Frontier. I'm excited to talk to you about it. I think you do a lot of stuff that doesn't always happen in the study of Chinese religions, where you bring in the kind of contemporary, you bring in the historical, and you put all that detail in really great conversation. So it's a wonderful book. Congrats.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here, and I look forward to the conversation.
So before we get into the book, we always start with a little bit about our authors. So could you tell us a little bit about what got you interested in the study of Buddhism and the study of religion, perhaps moments in your life or your career that were kind of influential in shaping the types of things you're interested or the ways you approach them?
Sure, yes. So I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, which some people may know is a place where there are a lot of folks interested in Buddhism and Asian religions in general. So I think my initial interest in Buddhism was part of that larger context. I was interested in Buddhism as someone who had not been raised in any religion because it seemed different from a lot of other religions in the way that I initially encountered it, which was very much a kind of Buddhist modernist, you know, Four Noble Truths sort of approach. And so when I started at the University of Oregon, I decided I would major in religious studies and focus primarily on Buddhism. I also started studying Chinese there because the university had a pretty good, you know, East Asian languages and literatures department, and there seemed to be a lot I could do with the intersections of Chinese and Buddhism. And it was during my undergraduate career that one of my main interests in Buddhism developed, namely in Buddhism and gender. A lot of people think that Buddhism is particularly enlightened, pun intended, in matters related to gender, you know, that it would be very egalitarian. And certainly there are discourses within Buddhism that reinforce that. but there's also a lot of other stuff. And it was the less egalitarian approaches to gender in Buddhism that really attracted my attention as an undergraduate. So I ended up under the excellent advising of my undergraduate mentor, Kyoko Tokuno, writing an honors thesis on the blood pond hell in Chinese Buddhism, which is a hell really just for women. So women end up in this hell because of the blood of menstruation and childbirth. And so I wrote this thesis trying to really kind of make sense of what this hell was doing in Chinese Buddhism. In that case, it was mainly focused on the modern period. So after I graduated undergrad, I wanted to continue pursuing these interests. And so I lived in Taiwan for a couple years to improve my Chinese and then applied for graduate programs. I ended up getting into Stanford's Buddhist Studies program. So I went there to work with primarily Bernard Faure, who had just published two books on Buddhism and gender. So at Stanford, I was obviously taking a lot of classes on Buddhism in East Asia. And I found myself getting interested in another gendered Buddhist figure, in this case, the goddess Hariti, who is known in Chinese as Guizimu, or Mother of Demons. She's a goddess who initially was a child eater, but then got converted to Buddhism and became a child giver. So I was really interested in how she, as a goddess, as a gendered figure, was understood in Chinese Buddhism. But in trying to figure out a dissertation topic, I couldn't quite find a real focal point for talking about the goddess Hariti in Chinese Buddhism. And then one day I was doing a search for Chinese language journal articles on Hariti, and I found all of these articles about the Dali region of what is now Southwest China's Yunnan province. And I learned that there were all of these references to Hariti in the Dali region. And in Dali, Hariti was often associated with another goddess known as Baijie. And so I ended up writing my dissertation about this goddess Baijie, which then became the basis for my book, Goddess on the Frontier.
I love hearing all these kind of the way these things weave back and forth. And it's great to hear kind of that background, that longer history that you have with this project. Maybe before we get into the details, you could just kind of introduce us briefly to Baijie. And I'm really interested now hearing more about your interest in gender as a kind of theoretical way of understanding Buddhism specifically. What is it about her that allows you to kind of think about these gendered local identities? And why do you think this particular deity is a good way to think about this kind of intersection of religion and gender in China?
So to start off, I want to sort of reassure everyone that it's normal that they haven't heard of this goddess Baijie before. she is not a very well-known figure, and it is precisely her local identity that I find so interesting in looking at her as a lens for understanding religion in Dali. So Baijie has a lot of different identities throughout her history. She first emerges in the Dali Kingdom, which was an independent regime located in what is now Yunnan Province in China. The Dali Kingdom lasted from 937 to 1253. And it's from this period that we start seeing images and texts related to this goddess Baijie. She probably develops as a kind of local transformation of the Hindu / Buddhist goddess Sri Lakshmi. And she is paired as a consort of a Buddhist god known as Mahakala. But later, my argument is that people sort of forget who she originally was as this Buddhist figure because her identity wasn't very stable in textual and other kinds of sources. And so people come up with different explanations for this name Baijie. So in the Ming Dynasty, which is roughly 1368 to 1644, we start seeing legends that identify Baijie as the mother of the founder of the Dali Kingdom. And in these stories, Baijie becomes pregnant through this kind of miraculous encounter with a dragon. This is, I should note, fairly common in Chinese religion. So in this case, there's a stick that floats into her while she was bathing. Surprise, it was a dragon in disguise. And so she becomes pregnant with Duan Siping, who is the eventual founder of the Dali Kingdom. And she herself also has a divine origin story that she is said to have been born from this giant plum that grew in the yard of an elderly couple who lacked any heirs. So she also has a kind of divine birth story herself. And so this figure, the mother of the Dali Kingdom founder, also becomes enshrined in temples in the Dali region and worshipped as a goddess. And then you get even later in the Qing Dynasty from 1644 to 1911, another identity of Baijie. And this is the one that most people know today. She's understood as a widow martyr, that is, a woman who chose to die rather than marry the man who killed her husband. So in this context, she really embodies a kind of Confucian notion of female chastity. So these three main identities, all tied to the name Baijie, each have a different kind of gendered significance. And so this is one of the reasons that I thought Baijie would be a really fascinating case study for looking at how a gendered figure, in this case, a goddess, changes over time in ways that kind of relate to the larger transformations of her locality. So I look at Baijie as a gendered figure. But as the title, I guess the subtitle of the book, which is Religion, Ethnicity, and Gender in Southwest China, also suggests, I'm interested in how she intersects with ethnicity as well. And this is one of the things that I'm trying to do with this book is get away from a kind of, I guess, sole focus on gender in the study of goddesses. I think gender is a really important part of who Baijie is in these different kind of incarnations. But I think it's equally important to think about gender in connection to other facets of identity. And that becomes ethnicity later in the history of Dali. In the earlier periods, I argue that it's hard to talk about ethnicity. So I can look at her in connection with a particular form of politico-religious self-representation. But I think that it's increasingly important not to isolate gender from these other categories of difference, but to see how they overlap and intersect.
Yeah, and I think the book does that really well. There's a lot to unpack with kind of that intro there. For a lot of people, they might not be familiar with Southwest China, this region that you're talking about. So maybe could you tell us a little bit about the peoples, the geographies of the Dali region? And then also, it's probably important to think about how these local identities relate to the various Chinese states from the early history that you begin the book with up until the present. Can you talk about the relationship between the two?
Yeah, so Dali is a kind of sub-region within what is now Yunnan province in southwest China. One of the reasons that I found it such an interesting place to focus on is that especially during the times when it was home to these two really a series of independent regimes from the 7th or 8th century with the Nanzhao Kingdom through the end of the Dali Kingdom in 1253, it was bordered by a real variety of different kinds of, you know, languages and cultures. So the Dali region to the north and northeast was bordered by Chinese states, so the Tang through the Song for the Nanzhao and Dali kingdoms. But to the northwest, it bordered Tibetan regions. To the west, it bordered what is now Myanmar or Burma, and then slightly farther west is India. And then to the south and southeast are various, you know, Southeast Asian cultures, including the Vietnamese regimes, the Li and Dai Viet, as well as slightly farther Champa, Bagan, those kinds of areas. So one of the things that I find continuously, you know, interesting about the Dali region is how the people there sort of crafted their own distinctive local traditions out of this, you know, wide array of possibilities. It's also meant that it's easy for scholars to project whatever they want onto Dali. If people want it to be Tibetan, they can make it Tibetan. If they want it to be Thai, they can make it Thai. Chinese, it's Chinese. And so I'm trying to go back and really look carefully at the historical materials to not assume that Dali was necessarily any one thing, but to see how the people there, you know, used their own agency in developing their own tradition. So that's what Dali is really up until the Mongol conquest of 1253. So in 1253, the Mongol army coming from the west deals with the Dali kingdom pretty easily. It's a fairly quick defeat. And then the Mongols go on to eventually defeat the southern Song dynasty and establish the Mongol Yuan dynasty, which lasts from about 1279 to 1368. With that, Dali is incorporated into a larger empire after having been an independent center for several centuries. And it's sort of interesting to see what happens in the Yuan dynasty. There's a really interesting dissertation by Jacqueline Armijo Hussein about a Muslim from Central Asia whom the Mongols basically hire to impose Confucian education in Yunnan. So there's a real kind of mix of cultural flows happening at this time. In the Ming Dynasty, which is founded in 1368, we really see the Dali region increasingly incorporated into a Chinese empire centered in the east. And it's in the Ming Dynasty when there's an influx of migrants from central and eastern China that starts settling in the Dali region and in Yunnan in general. And this trend continues into the Qing Dynasty, which is founded in 1644, when more and more people from the sort of Chinese interior start moving into Yunnan, mainly for employment. Mining was extremely prevalent in Yunnan. And so this takes us into the modern period. So Yunnan, becomes a province in the modern, you know, states of the Republic of China and then the People's Republic of China, where Yunnan is really, I think, the most diverse province. It has, I believe, 26 of the officially recognized minority nationalities are based in Yunnan. So it's demographically diverse. It's also geographically diverse. You have the, foothills of the Himalaya Mountains in the northwest, but then when you get to the far south, it's very, similar to Southeast Asia, very hot kind of jungle territory. And then you have everything in between. So it's a very, geographically and demographically diverse area, really, I think, from the early periods I look at up through the present.
Now, knowing this background, it makes sense that kind of the history of Buddhism and its transmission into the region would be different from kind of what we think of as China proper. But could you tell us a little bit about this history? You do this in the first chapter. What do we need to know about the development of Buddhism in the region, and how did the local expression of the tradition relate to both Chinese and Indian formulations?
Yeah. So, based on the sources that we have, which I should note are fairly limited, it appears that the main routes of transmission for Buddhism to enter the Dali region came from the Tang Dynasty, Tang territory. And the Tang Dynasty lasted from 618 to 907. So during that time, there was a lot of contact between the polity that ruled the Dali region, which was called Nanzhao, and the Tang forces. And the Tang were really interested in the Dali area at this time because Tibet was growing as a threat to Tang dynasty power, and the Tang court wanted an ally near Tibet to keep Tibet in check. So we have a lot of data on those interactions between Nanzhao and the Tang dynasty. So it's likely that those interactions were the source really for Buddhism entering the Nanzhao polity. And by this, I think mean Buddhist texts, because the elites, at least in the Dali region, starting with the Nanzhao kingdom, they read Sinitic script as opposed to primarily reading Sanskrit or Tibetan or any other language. So they're getting their textual material from the Tang. I increasingly think that there were other routes for the transmission of Buddhist images and material culture. So I think that there were some images that were actually entering the area from Southeast Asia and probably from India as well. But I still think that in terms of artistic styles and forms, as well as textual materials, the main source was probably the Sichuan region, which is directly to the north of Yunnan. And in fact, there are records of the Nanzhao court educating their sons in Sichuan, as well as occasionally raiding the main city of Chengdu and kidnapping artisans and other people to come back to Nanzhao and work there. We also know that the Nanzhao forces kidnapped some Tang officials and brought them back to serve as imperial tutors for Nanzhao. So we think that a lot of Nanzhao Buddhism and what became Dali Kingdom Buddhism probably entered from Tang territory. However, the way that Nanzhao rulers or the Nanzhao court in general represented that Buddhist transmission emphasizes the Indian route much more strongly. So there's one source from the late Nanzhao period, from 899, Nanzhao falls in 903, called the Nanzhao Tu Zhuan, which means Illustrated History of Nanzhao. It's a great source. It recounts first in images and then in text how Buddhism was, at least theoretically, introduced to the region. And it claims that a particular bodhisattva, the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara or Guanyin, introduced Buddhism to the region in the guise of an Indian monk. So it really is making the claim that even though there might have been other Buddhist transmissions entering the Dali region from Tibet, from Chinese territory, from Central Asia, the main transmission was from India. And the visual representation of this particular form of the Bodhisattva Guanyin, which is Atsuye Guanyin or Invincible Guanyin, that actual image is probably based on a statue that entered the region from Southeast Asia, probably from Champa in what's now sort of southern Vietnam. So there's a real disjuncture between what the historical record suggests to us about how Buddhism entered the Dali region and how people in Dali, specifically the Nanzhao and then the Dali courts, represented their Buddhist transmission. And I argue that the reason for this is that Nanzhao and Dali's proximity to India gave them an advantage in claiming a direct Indian transmission for their Buddhist tradition. That in the eyes of, say, the Tang or Song dynasties, Dali's proximity to India gave them a kind of superior status in the realm of Buddhist discourse. By contrast, the people in Dali could never claim superiority in the realm of, say, Confucian discourse, which they also were very familiar with and also used in some of their other writings.
Now, you've introduced us a little bit to kind of the discourse around Baijie during this early period of the Dali Kingdom. Can you tell us a little bit more about how her identity was constructed during this period, and why were Dali rulers kind of employing it? And then also you go into a little bit more detail in the chapter about how ideas about gender during this period are shaping the construction of Baijie in particular ways. So can you walk us through a little bit more of this history?
Yeah, so Baijie shows up in several sources from the Dali Kingdom. One of these is this magnum opus of Dali Kingdom Buddhist art from the 1170s called the Fanxiangzhuan, or Roll of Buddhist Images. It's a really amazing work of art. It consists of paintings of a wide variety of Buddhist figures, bodhisattvas, Chan patriarchs, wrathful Dharma guardians, as well as Nanzhao and Dali rulers. And Baijie shows up toward the end of the painting in the section of Dharma guardians, that is, you know, gods in Buddhism that aren't necessarily understood as awakened beings, but who are powerful beings capable of protecting Buddhism and Buddhists from potential threats. So she shows up toward the end, and her image is really striking. She's a feminine figure wearing a long sort of full coverage robe, and she looks in general like an elegant, you know, Chinese lady, except for the fact that there are three snake heads framing her face. So there's one snake directly above her head and then one on each side of her head. She's also standing on serpent coils. So this signifies her identity as a serpent goddess. Her skin is also a bit darker than the skin of other figures in the scroll. And in this scroll, she is standing next to the Buddhist god with whom she's paired, the god Mahakala, whose name means great black god in Chinese. It's Dahe Tianshen. So Mahakala is a trans-regional Buddhist figure who is known for protecting the Buddhist teachings. He's often depicted as a wrathful figure with serpents and skulls adorning him. And he's depicted, you know, with fangs, with, you know, extra eyes and limbs, and is dressed, you know, with much less coverage. He generally only wears a tiger skin skirt, and you know, the top half of his body is bare. So they form a kind of pair in this painting that I argue really reflects how Dali court Buddhists were engaging with gendered religious imagery. For Mahakala, the god, I argue that he embodies a kind of wrathful masculinity that for the rulers of Dali signifies a kind of non-Chineseness, and that the Dali rulers were trying to tap into this image of, you know, so-called barbarian or barbaric masculinity to augment their perceived power in relation to the Song dynasty. In contrast with Baijie, her image does evoke certain kinds of Indian-ness or non-Chinese aspects of identity, but the Dali court does not depict her in the same way that Indian dragon or snake goddesses are depicted, which is to say, you know, wearing very little clothing, you know, often with very exaggerated hourglass figures, or in a kind of obvious sexual union with a male counterpart. So with Baijie, the Dali court artists are really restraining themselves and making sure that she still conforms to, so at least quasi-Chinese notions of acceptable femininity. So whereas a kind of gender difference in connection to ethnicity is really emphasized with Mahakala and masculinity, it is definitely not emphasized with Baijie and femininity, that for a lot of these rulers, you know, female deities are not the place to emphasize, you know, gendered ethnic differences. So that's, I think, an important aspect of understanding Baijie's image in the Dali kingdom. And this, I think, is an aspect of her identity that continues into later periods as well.
Yeah. And so in the next chapter, you move into the Ming period during the 15th century. And you began to tell us this very interesting narrative in terms of how Baijie is narrativized during this period. Can you tell us a little bit about why she's constructed in this particular way? Why is this narrative becoming important during this period? What kind of themes are emerging from this story? And then it also, you kind of explain it in relation to the Dali elites, which are, in terms of a social context, have a very different position than they did during the Dali kingdom. So what is going on in this period? Why are we seeing this change?
So the Ming conquest really ushers in a sea change in the Dali region, because even after the Mongol conquest, the authorities in Dali still retained some of their existing power. But with the Ming conquest, the influx of Chinese migrants really changed the landscape in Dali, and especially Dali elites and the educated elite were really forced to confront the stereotype of themselves as, so-called barbarians. And I think that a lot of the legends that develop at this time, including the legend surrounding Baijie's second identity, that of Baijie Ame, the mother of Duan Siping, the founder of the Dali kingdom, are responses to the Ming conquest and an attempt to assert the legitimacy and importance of existing lineages in the Dali area. So the narrative that emerges is the one, as you said, that I sort of summarized earlier, which says that there was an older couple in the area of the Dali plain who lacked any heirs. And so they, performed rituals, made sacrifices. And then one day when they were outside, they saw this giant plum had grown in their backyard. When the plum split open, this, lovely girl emerged. And so they raised this girl. She one day is bathing in the river and a piece of wood floats into her foot, whereupon she becomes pregnant. And then we learn that the piece of wood was actually a dragon in disguise. She gives birth to twin sons, one of whom goes on to found the Dali kingdom. So the way I understand this legend is that the sources that recount the legend come from a couple of families in the Dali Plain area, especially the Yang family. And I think that the Yang family really was claiming this woman, this Baijie, as one of their own ancestors, and they're trying to insert themselves into the kind of exalted history of the Dali region. They're also tapping into narrative tropes that come up in classical Chinese antiquity as well. There are a lot of stories in classical Chinese antiquity of rulers being born from dragons, whether it's, the founder of the Han Dynasty, whose mother is said to have conceived him when she had a dream about a dragon coming to her while on the banks of a river, or just the idea of the dragon as a symbol of imperial status. So I think that, this narrative is taking these, transregional narrative tropes and transplanting them to the Dali area, giving the rulers of the Dali kingdom retroactively a kind of divine origin that then their later descendants in the Dali plane can claim as well, as a way of augmenting their status with relation to these newly arrived, you know, Ming officials, as well as Chinese migrants from the interior. So I read it as a way of pushing back against this perception of Dali as a kind of peripheral backwater and its people as, you know, so-called barbarians.
Now, this narrative of Bai Jie as a widow martyr is also kind of emerging at a time when the social factors are shifting. So how was this story being retold during this period? And how was her identity kind of interpreted by both the Bai community, the local community, but then also from Han Chinese who were becoming more present during this period?
Yeah, so the widow martyr narrative, the story itself starts to emerge as early as the Yuan dynasty. And Bai Jie, the name, doesn't get tied to it until the Qing dynasty of 1644 to 1911. So to recount this story in a little bit more detail, the account goes that when the one of the Nanjiao rulers was trying to conquer his five regional rivals, he invited them all to worship their shared ancestors at his capital with the plan that once he got them upstairs in the tower and got them drunk, he could sneak back down, set the structure on fire, and kill them all, thereby, you know, being able to much more easily take over their respective kingdoms. So the story goes that the ruler of one of these other regimes called the Dengdan regime, he was married to Bai Jie. And Bai Jie warns him, you know, don't go, it's a trap. He's going to, you know, do something shady. But her husband says, I really have no choice. I have to go. So Bai Jie affixes an iron bracelet to his arm and sends him on his way. Sure enough, the Nanjiao ruler ends up, you know, setting this tower on fire, killing his five rivals, one of whom was Bai Jie's husband. All of the loved ones of these, you know, murdered rulers come to the Nanjiao capital to retrieve the bodies, but Bai Jie is the only one who can identify her husband's body because she had the foresight of giving him the iron bracelet. The Nanjiao ruler is then entranced by Bai Jie's beauty and her intelligence and asks her to marry him. And she, you know, basically says, you know, sure, okay, I'll marry you. Just let me go back to my capital and get ready first. And so he agrees. She goes back to her capital and shuts herself in inside. And then there are varying explanations for how she ends up dying. But the sort of short version is that she decides to die rather than marry the man who killed her husband. And so this story coincides, both with the increasing encroachment of the Chinese state in Dali, but also with the rise of the so-called chastity cult in late imperial China. So this is the idea that chastity was becoming the preeminent virtue for women. And in some cases, the Ming and Qing states would award women who remained chaste after their husband's death, or, you know, in some cases, even who committed suicide rather than, be raped or sexually harassed. So it has to, I think the rise of this form of Bai Jie has to be understood within this context. So in the context of late imperial Dali, I think this story and Bai Jie's role within it does different things for the locals in Dali, the kind of native Dali elites, as well as for officials of the Ming and Qing dynasties. I think for the local Dali elites, because feminine virtue tends to be held up as a marker of civilization versus barbarism, Dalí elites could use this story as evidence that their ancestors, that the people of Dalí, had long known Confucian feminine virtue, that their women in particular were chaste and virtuous, such that, you know, they could hopefully counteract Han or Chinese stereotypes about, you know, minority women or so-called barbarian women as sexually promiscuous. At the same time, for the officials of the Ming and Qing dynasties, this story about Baijie as a widow martyr served as a kind of proof that their civilizing projects in the Southwest or in other newly conquered territories could be successful. There are also some, especially gazetteers from this period, that remark on, you know, how exceptional Baijie is, because they thought it was so unusual that a so-called barbarian woman could embody this kind of virtue without the benefit of, you know, more extensive Confucian influence. So I think that this narrative about Baijie, the widow martyr, one of the reasons it was so successful in this period is that it had something to offer both outsiders as well as Dalí locals. In terms of regular people, it's much harder to know from the historical record what this narrative meant for them. What really comes out of the, especially gazetteers, was that even as the local and outside elites were really trying to present this form of Baijie as an exemplar, you know, as a figure to be emulated rather than as an efficacious goddess, probably most people were engaging with Baijie, even in her widow martyr form, as an efficacious goddess, that is, praying for good fortune, you know, praying for rain, for, you know, sons, things of that nature. So I think that there's also some hints of a gap between this official version of Baijie and the more popular understanding of Baijie.
And this kind of understanding by regular people, as you put it, you kind of tackle that in the last chapter, which looks at Baijie in the modern period. And this I feel like you could have written a whole book on just this chapter, because it really does a lot of work. So I'm interested because, especially given the subtitle of the book, this is really where you tackle state notions of the category of religion, of ideas about ethnicity, and you take us through how those shape interpretations, recent interpretations of Baijie. So what does she come to mean in the modern period? How does this kind of new kind of discursive and social context change how people understand her?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that this chapter could have been a book unto itself. And I think it's only my, I guess, feeling humbled in doing the kind of ethnographic work that underpins this chapter that has, I guess, made me realize how very difficult it would be to do a book-length project just on the kind of modern and contemporary period. You know, engaging with lived religion in the way that I did for the last chapter was extremely valuable, especially for, I think, the light it shed on earlier historical periods and kind of cluing me into all of the things that I simply don't have access to in looking to the past, because I entered my encounters with, you know, people during various forms of fieldwork with a lot of assumptions that they pretty handily dismantled. And one of the main assumptions, which I think I address in that chapter, is the expectation that people today would think about Baijie as an ethnic goddess. Because one of the main ways of writing her name could be understood as Bai sister, and the Bai people or the Bai Minzu are really centered in the Dalí area of Yunnan province. In fact, Dali is known as Dali Bai Autonomous Prefecture. So I went in initially with this expectation that Bai Jie would be this great ethnic goddess. When I talked to, you know, a lot of the local scholars or tourism officials, they reinforced that assumption. But when I went to a lot of Bai Jie temples and talked to the people there, many of whom are middle-aged and older women, who are the people generally in charge of village religion in this part of China and elsewhere, ethnicity didn't really come up. Or if it came up, it was because I introduced the category of ethnicity or minzu in asking, you know, who worships Bai Jie, you know, which minzu. And sometimes people would say, oh, the Bai minzu, or in some cases, you know, the Han, the Bai. But in a lot of cases, you know, people really didn't seem sure, mainly because that wasn't the way that they generally thought about Bai Jie. And what I learned, especially in talking to the women who are in charge of a lot of the Bai Jie temples in village religion, was that they tended to volunteer more gendered categories in talking about Bai Jie. And these tended to be related to her, you know, chastity, to her beauty. You know, she's often described as kind of a mother to the people who live in a particular village. And I should clarify that in Dali now, a lot of villages have their own kind of tutelary, you know, protector deities known as Banzhu. And so Bai Jie is one of these village deities. So certain villages will have her as their main guardian. So the fact that a lot of villagers, a lot of the women in particular, talked about Bai Jie in gendered rather than ethnic terms, I still think relates to the ways in which gender and ethnicity intersect in contemporary China, which is to say that these perceptions of minority women as promiscuous or sexually uninhibited still persist, especially in the Southwest. There are a lot of, you know, kind of salacious write-ups about you know, certain minority nationalities or ethnic groups in Yunnan province that really present them as being unrestrained in contrast to the buttoned up, you know, Confucian Han. And so I think for a lot of women who are of minority nationalities in Yunnan, including the Bai women and sometimes Han women I talk to, there's not much to gain from emphasizing gendered ethnic difference. And in that way, I think that there are continuities that continue from the Dali kingdom. So I think in some ways, the emphasis on Bai Jie's gendered characteristics and the continued emphasis on her chastity and eliding ethnicity is a way of, you know, arguing for possessing the same kind of, you know, Confucian virtue as Han women. I think another aspect of this is that, you know, village religion in Dali did not kind of develop within the constraints of ethnicity. And so there are plenty of mixed villages where some people might, you know, have ID cards labeling them Bai, others might have ID cards labeling them as Han, but they still might participate in the same kinds of religious practices. The ethnicization of Dali religion is really a product of the attempt, I think, to reify certain forms of ethnic culture. And for some scholars and tourism officials of the Bai ethnicity, one of the things they confront is a perception of the Bai as being too sinicized, that is, as being too Chinese. And so there's a pressure to identify that which distinguishes Bai culture, including Bai religion, from Han religion. And the worship of these local deities known as Banzhu has been one of the things that has been sort of defined increasingly in these Bai ethnic terms. And I open the book with an account of this grand reopening of a Bai Jie temple in the Dali region that I think is being really incorporated into a kind of ethno-tourism that is turning, you know, Dalí's local religion into a really kind of distinctively Bai religious practice in ways that you don't find historically. So I think these are some of the things that are coming up. In terms of religious discourse, this is also, of course, a tricky thing to navigate, in part because a lot of local religion, if it's not clearly Buddhist or Taoist or, you know, Islamic or Christian, doesn't get the official religion category, that category of zongjiao. So it occupies a kind of gray area that, you know, can be sort of dealt with Bai calling it traditional culture, or in this case, ethnic culture. So I think the worship of Baijie, you know, does change as people are engaging with these, you know, categories of modernity, including religion, ethnicity, and to some extent, gender.
I'm wondering also, it's a wonderful book, Megan. Congrats again. And I think you really do a great job of kind of bringing in this historical detail, attention to textual resources, but then also bringing in this contemporary part, which I don't think happens a lot. In the study of Chinese religions, I wonder if you just have any reflections on studying religion in China and kind of giving us this broad sweep of both the historical and the contemporary.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the kind words. And of course, I would have liked a little more room to explore some of the periods that I deal with because it ends up being a bit of a whirlwind through this 1,000-year-long history.
Sure.
To me, you know, one of my inspirations in thinking about this project was Brigitte Baptandier's study of a goddess called Lin Shui Furen, or Lady Close to the Water, who's a deity mainly in Southeast China and Taiwan. And Baptandier also does this kind of longitudinal study where she looks at Lin Shui Furen in, you know, roughly, I think, starting around the Song Dynasty, but then also does some ethnographic work focused on this deity's spirit mediums in modern and contemporary Taiwan in particular. And so that was inspiring to me methodologically, because I do think there's something that you can only get at by engaging with living people. for me, I don't think Baijie's story would have been complete without thinking about how her contemporary devotees are engaging with her. As I said, I think it also, you know, gave me insights into the earlier materials, especially just including me into how much I don't know and can't know about how people in, you know, the Nanjiao and Dali kingdoms, in the Ming and Qing dynasties, actually engaged with and made meaning with the goddess Baijie. You know, I think lived religion, it's so complex. It was a truly humbling experience. You know, I had worked a little bit with some anthropology professors at Stanford, you know, while I was finishing up grad school. But, you know, I really felt that that is something that, you know, needs, I think, more attention. And I'm in awe of the many anthropologists who do this work, you know, more regularly. So I think it was really a necessary part of this puzzle for what I was trying to do with Baijie. And I'm really grateful to the people of the Dali region who indulged my many questions, especially, you know, the ones that probably to them came out of left field.
People I'm sure are interested to hear what you're up to now. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on and things we might hope for in the future?
Yeah, so I have a couple of things right now. I'm sticking in Dali for my second book project, or second monograph, which is going to be on esoteric Buddhist networks around the Dali Kingdom. So even though I'm sticking in Dali geographically, I'm going back to a much narrower historical period, but trying to, I guess, trace the connections between the Dali area and surrounding regions. And what I'm really hoping to do with this is trace out these textual, visual, and material networks, because I increasingly think that even though the textual networks mainly tied the Dali area to, you know, Tang and Song territory, I think the visual and material networks sort of show stronger connections to some other neighboring regions. So I'm looking at how Dali Buddhists were participating in these kind of broader, you know, trans-regional networks. So that's one project. Another project is an edited volume on Buddhist masculinities that I'm working on with a colleague at Northwestern, Kevin Buckaloo. So we've been soliciting, you know, contributions from scholars working on Buddhism across a wide variety of regions and time periods. And we really hope to, you know, fully expand the study of gender in Buddhism. You know, I think most people now kind of realize that gender is not just women and not just, you know, the feminine, however that is defined, but also includes, you know, men and masculinity. And so we're really trying to, you know, extend the study of gender in Buddhism and also make something that, you know, hopefully people who are teaching classes on Buddhism and gender, Buddhism and sexuality can use. So that's what I've got going on right now. So I think taking some of the themes of this book and running with them in slightly different directions.
Well, good luck, Megan, and thanks for making the time to talk about this wonderful book.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and thank you again for letting me talk about Goddess on the Frontier.
That was my conversation with Megan Bryson about Goddess on the Frontier, Religion, Ethnicity, and Gender in Southwest China, published with Stanford University Press in 2016. Thanks again for supporting New Books in Religion. I hope you'll check out another episode soon.